Hey everyone, welcome to the Wild and Uncut podcast brought to you by Ruger. I'm your host, Christy Titus. Thank you for tuning in. The line is going hot, so let's go full send on this episode. Since 1949, Ruger has embodied the spirit of hunting in America. Ruger firearms are built to deliver the reliable and accurate performance that seasoned veterans demand and new hunters can trust. At Ruger, we believe that hunting is about more than just the thrill of the chase. It's about the freedom and opportunity that come with it. This is our heritage, and this is Ruger. Hey, everybody, thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Wild and Uncut podcast. We're at the NRA convention at the Ruger booth, and I'm with fellow Ruger ambassador and host of Trailing the Hunter's Moon, Blake Barnett. And you have been kind of grandfathered into the Ruger family.
I have.
By Larry Wysoon, which we love Larry.
Yeah.
Larry is the kind of...
He's the godfather of the outdoors.
I was going to say the kingpin of Ruger.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, Christy. And it's an honor to follow in his footsteps. He's blazed a trail for me throughout my entire career.
For a lot of people, actually.
And for a lot of people, yes. Yeah. So my background, you know, is spending about 15 years with Larry as his cameraman, as his then producer, as then a co-host of, you know, Trailing the Hunter's Moon, which is after a book that he won a bunch of awards with, to inheriting the show and the series basically from him. And
is that been like no pressure? I've got to try to fill the shoes of Larry Wysoon. Like no pressure at all there. Like seriously, the
lots
man
of
is
pressure.
Is
you
a
know,
legend.
I'll be honest with you. Yeah, I think at the most pressure I've ever had in my career. It's been about we're going on year four since I've inherited that. And you know, you never know how that's going to be received. You know, I honestly felt like I was overwhelmed with the opportunity. You know, I definitely was scared that I had to keep up with it and scared of how it was going to be received. And we're going into season 18, you know, and you being an entrepreneur yourself, you think of all the things you've done and, you know, you've been a part of other shows, other organizations where you were co-hosting and then you step out on your own and you think I'm going to start a new brand. Should I do that? Or am I, you know, you have that. I kind of want to do that, but my gosh, this brand is so big, but I'm not Larry Wysoon, you know?
Are you saying you don't shoot a number one?
Oh, I shoot a number one, and I collect a number one. And Larry and I are probably both jealous over our own collections that we both have. But no, people still watching, you know? People still vote on the digital awards, and, you know, I believe in your own authenticity, and so I don't try to be Larry. I hope people don't judge me that way, but...
Well, and you know, I think it's important that we all are our own unique individual.
Absolutely.
Like, you bring strengths to the table that maybe were weaknesses of Larry. Not that Larry has any weaknesses. the man is brilliant. I mean, he's a wildlife biologist. He knows everything about plants and ecosystems and... I mean, he is just a fantastic human, wonderful brand ambassador. But you are equally, you know, as incredible.
Well,
so
thank you.
In your own rights.
Yeah. Well, you are too. You know, I've met you through Larry.
Yeah.
And through, you know, the Ruger ambassador team that you've been a part of. And I, this is year three for me. So I still feel like a new kid on the block there, you know, following.
I do too.
Following, you know. A legend that you've created in yourself and a legacy that you have started for women in the outdoors and in the shooting because you cover so many spectrums. And, you know, I started back 20 years in this business, you know, with Larry before there was all the digital stuff, you know, to see these new media outlets come on board and see what you've done for the industry. Yeah, honored to work with you. So.
Yeah, it's been a great ride. So walk everybody through kind of a day in a life of you.
Yeah, so...
What does that look like?
Man, you know, I think I said it in the in the team meeting we had before the NRA show started, I'm kind of this cowboy gypsy.
Yeah.
You know, I born and raised in Texas, professional horseman before I went into the media world.
He still has a stallion that's over 30 years old.
32 years old. Lives with my mom.
Not in the same house.
You know, his name is Vested, so yeah. I guess he's made a vested interest in his own life to live that long and looks phenomenal. Yeah, professional horseman. Grew up in the horse world. Competition, trained professionally for the AQHA,
yeah.
Hauled a lot, showed in the open divisions as a professional, but hauled and trained for a lot of youth and amateur and non-pro riders, all the way to a world level, showed nationally. Mm-hmm. So a lot of respect for what you do with your horses and mules. That's what I love about it.
I only have one horse, singular, and he's ancient. He's now 21. I got him when he was one.
Yeah.
And he's been my buddy for 20 years,
Yeah, they are. They're family.
They are
They're family.
Family.
But a hunter all my life. Hunter, since, my dad probably started taking me when I was 4 or 5. I shot my first white-tailed deer when I was 7. And, when you go through life and you become independent, my work, as a professional horseman, was to save money to take a hunting trip somewhere once a year. And that's where I started getting into my international hunting role.
Yeah.
As I started to hunt internationally, and that was my vacation for the year. And, through the professional equine industry, we used a lot of video and media to sell very expensive, horses, horses that we sold for well into the six-figure level, and we used.
I've got a bunch of those at home.
used video to market that stuff.
Yeah.
And so when I started doing my, my international hunts, I took cameras with me, and I was like, God, I love this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I believe, good man, good Lord up above really watches us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts us in places where things present themselves. And actually had a family friend, you may remember him, that was in the industry for a good while, from Texas as well, Mr. Kim Hicks. Had a magazine in Texas called the Texas Hunting Directory.
Okay.
And when outdoor television kind of really first hit the scenes big, ESPN, those networks back in the day, a lot of those magazine holders were giving up their magazines to go kind of into television.
Yeah.
And I had a couple of horse accidents and had one really bad one, and that I had took me about 3 months to recover from. And once I was able to get back on a horse, the first one I got on tripped and fell and rolled over me.
Oof.
So again, I think somebody was trying to tell me something.
Yeah.
I was like, I need to do something different. So it was a very hard decision to make, and met with all my clients and had to tell them that I needed to focus on a healthier lifestyle.
Yeah.
Where I wouldn't be crippled the rest of my life. And I just walked away from it. People couldn't believe it. But a door opened up for me through Kim Hicks, and I went to work for him to learn how to field produce with a camera. I was already pretty savvy around some video equipment just with.
And Blake's a big guy. But he had a camera that had 6-pound batteries, okay?
Yeah, let's,
like,
I mean,
you take a waist belt full of 6-pound batteries.
Yeah, I mean, like, back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, you're like, I was a much younger man then.
Yeah, exactly. And I struggled. I mean, the cameras were 30, 35 pounds. The tripod head was 30 pounds, battery belts, and big cassette tapes that you could only get 15 minutes at a time. So you had to carry a backpack full of tapes to film for the day, And so it was one thing if you sat in a deer blind or sat on the ground, but if you had to hike, Larry Weising took me to Saskatchewan, Canada, and we were in the hills hunting white-tailed deer, and there was thick alders and stuff, and Larry likes to walk and move, and we started up this one hill, and I mean, that white-tailed deer hunt felt like a sheep hunt for me carrying all this stuff. And I finally had to grab him by the collar and was like, here, you carry this tripod. If this is where we're going to go,
Can you please slow down?
But it's amazing what today's equipment, we talked about that already. I mean, the cameras are this big now, affordable.
The quality, even just off of our phones, unbelievable.
Yeah, so I worked through those whole years, for lots of different productions as a field producer. Larry Weissen and I worked as a team for Winchester World of Whitetails.
Yeah.
Which was, I think, probably the staple of what really branded Larry as a TV personality.
Yeah.
You know, it was an award-winning show, very well sponsored. And that, I think, is what really kicked off mine and Larry's relationship and my career from a recognizable standpoint to be able to do more for other production companies as a freelance field producer. And that evolved into Larry and I one day saying, you know what, let's, instead of working for these other production companies, let's
do our own.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of my idea.
Were you with Trailing the Hunter's Moon from year one as a field producer?
From year one. So it was,
wow.
It was my idea.
I didn't realize that.
I'll be honest
okay.
with you, but Larry will tell you, it was my idea because I was like, Larry, you know, I mean, we were jumping around, you know, Larry was getting these different offers. They were all great offers.
Yeah.
They were great series. But, you know, it wasn't his. And I'm like,
let's
need your own.
Own our
and
own
I was like,
brand.
You wrote this book. It won a bunch of awards. You know, it sold lots of copies. And I was like, it's appropriate. People back then didn't they labeled Larry, and he's still labeled that way today, as Mr. Whitetail, right?
Oh, 100%.
But Larry has hunted the world, literally. And that's what this book was about, was to kind of tell another side of him.
Yeah.
And so we went to all the partners, you know, we went to Ruger, we went to Hornady. There were some other partners that were involved in the beginning, like Zeiss, and everybody loved the idea. And I'm going to say that was 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And we're here today.
Yeah.
You know, and Larry's slowed down, moved closer to be with his family.
Mm-hmm.
He's not traveling as much. Riding more probably now.
Oh, I'm sure.
And still very active. And, you know, here we are. We're doing it.
So 18 years you've been every step of this trail.
20 now.
Yeah.
I'm 48 and I started at 28. I said, I got to do something different.
At 28. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I was 27 when I started full time in the outdoor industry as well. Like professionally doing various things. And I've done a lot of things from retail sales and clothing and textile to where I am today.
And
so
it's interesting.
We were at the same point. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting how we've all evolved through this, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, even just, I think people look at all of us as TV personalities, digital influencers. There's a lot more I know you do, and there's a lot more that I do behind the scenes, you know. Conservation and hunter advocacy have become big passions and missions of mine. I know is
of course.
Yours as well. Yeah. And in today's crazy world we're living in, there seems to be, I feel like, more we have to do there, even to make our own consumers and our own fellow hunters aware of pressures that are encroaching more and more each year.
Yeah.
There are a lot of Americans that understand the value of hunting. But we all know that right now, national support of hunting is extremely volatile. It seems that with every passing day, our voice is diminished and the court of public opinion is not effectively hearing our side. We need advocates working on our behalf in Washington, D.C. to defend our freedom to hunt. And thankfully, when we need it the most, we have that advocate in Safari Club International. SCI's world headquarters are located in Washington, D.C., just blocks from the United States Capitol, which means that SCI is on the ground with our congressional leaders and federal agencies on our behalf, on behalf of the hunting community. SCI has an active political presence in all 50 states through their extensive chapter network and government affairs staff. If you have ever wondered why you should be a member of SCI, you shouldn't wonder anymore. Join us in the fight to defend hunting. Go to safariclub.org to learn more.
You just did a really incredible, it's tied with the second highest fundraising net producer in conservation history. So we have the first... the number one would be the mule deer hunt that sold at the MDF banquet this year. It went for $725,000. There was an Antelope Island mule deer hunt that sold this year for $500,000.
Yeah.
But you did something that nobody's ever done, which is a non-hunt
conservation fundraiser that netted $500,000.
Yeah, that was, you know, hunters.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, so going back again to what I just said about you and I trying to be the voices and sounds to make raise awareness of to our own fellow hunters and to people in the shooting community that I feel like we have to do more.
Yeah.
And we have to think outside the box. You know, from the hunting side, you know, we get a lot of scrutiny. We got a lot of fingers pointing at us. And I think that we all even are at fault for pointing fingers back. You know what I mean? And we have to have a narrative and blend a narrative to make people, I think, understand truly how are we the conservationists? Because what do? We go out there and shoot things when you just look at a media side, you know, or look at social media, you know, and just see pictures.
Well, the story is not taught. I mean, hunters do a relatively poor job of explaining how hunting is conservation. And even a lot of hunters don't understand how they're funding.
How the funding works.
Conservation.
That's right. So what I did was I've been tied to international hunting organizations throughout my 20 years, DSC, Dallas Safari Club, being the main one. And they do amazing work. They have done great things for years. They spend a lot of money, especially on the international platform of hunting. You know, anti-poaching is a big thing in Africa that they fund. But they work, you know, in Washington as well and advocate, you know, hunter advocacy, you know, right here in North America. They fund a lot of North American wildlife projects as well. But I met a gentleman from South Africa, Mr. Rorn Rippen, owner of Buffalo Kloof Conservancy.
Which, by the way, he and I have brother dogs. Our Ridgebacks are full brothers.
That's crazy.
Like, I walked by his booth at SCI, no, at Sheep Show a couple years ago, and I was like, why do you have a picture of my dog on your booth? He's like, what are you talking about?
That's crazy.
And they're brothers.
That's amazing.
And so now, when he talks about his dog's personality traits, and I talk about my dog, I'm like, oh, we have the same dog.
Yeah.
Like, it's unbelievable. So now I love him
by
default because our dogs are brothers.
Whoa.
And actually, I want to go there and hunt with him just because I want to see his dog.
And you have to go see this conservancy. So
it's incredible.
I met him in 2020, but 2019, he was responsible for the largest ever translocation of black rhinos. And it was pretty well privately funded by him. And I was like, why is this story not being told? Like, what? You were responsible for the largest? And he's like... And he's been a very successful businessman in South Africa. But when he did that, and he translocated him and moved him to his preserve, which is a hunting preserve as well.
Yes, which goes to show you how hunters are conservationists. He's trying to aid in a horribly imperiled species, not even with the intention of hunt, but with the intention of this is good for the wildlife and the landscape, and it's the right thing to do, has the means to help.
He had the means to do it, and it got recognition from either, you know, from non-hunting organizations as well, like WWF, which, you know, receives most of their funding from groups that are not going to support hunting. But,
non-hunting.
You know, he was able to make them listen to say, listen, it's going to be a hunting property or hunting preserve that is going to be able to protect this endangered species. One, because we hunt on this property, so you know it's a higher risk for the poachers to come in and try to come into a property where
you have armed guards.
That's
basically
right, and there are people hunting on
and
it.
And we all know an armed citizen is a safer citizen.
Absolutely. So fast forward, you know, COVID hit. We got to this year, and I met with him at the DSC convention in January. And to add to it, I serve and was one of the founders of one of the chapters, DSC South Texas, based out of San Antonio, Texas, that's where I'm from. And I went to him with an idea that, you know, it was a custodianship idea. I said, you know, I know that Mr. Rippen is planning another translocation, hopefully to take place this year. It will be the second largest one and quite possibly the last one ever for the black rhino. And I just started thinking outside of the box, and I went to him and threw the idea of a custodianship of a rhino, you know, not to ever be hunted. But if it raised a lot of funds, it could go towards more land expansion, habitat expansion, maybe security, maybe that security being in, you know, transmitters or collars or beacon towers, or even to go towards funding the next translocation. And I think he looked at me like, can you really do this? Or, I mean, I love the idea, but kind of like,
Can this really be happen? Can this really happen with a non-hunting scenario?
Yeah, and my fundraiser was 4 months away. And I went and got the president of the chapter and a fellow director, brought them to the booth. And I think even they were thinking, Juan, I don't know if this is possible. Do you really think you can do this? And
yeah.
Warren said, I'll do it. We left the meeting, and the president of DSC South Texas said, look, this must be your wheelhouse because I don't know how to put this together. So
yeah.
I said, let me do it. Will you let me do it? I don't want any other board to interrupt me, you know, member. I want this to be quiet, too, because it had never been done before. I didn't want the idea to be stolen. And it was either going to work or it was going to fail, and I was just going to take on that responsibility. And April 1st was our fundraiser. I had worked very hard for those 4 months to kind of organize and look for people that I thought this would catch the attention of, caught the attention of some folks, had them come in. Going into the event, I knew I was going to at least meet a goal, which was 100,000.
Yeah.
I knew we were going to, then that is big. I don't care for a chapter, it's huge. And even for the parent organizations, that's big for an auction item to bring six figures.
Six figures is a big number.
And it brought $500,000.
Unbelievable number.
And so it broke a
like
history.
I said, it's the it, for a non-hunting,
yeah.
It's the highest grossing fundraiser.
Highest grossing fundraiser, the most money ever raised for rhino conservation. It was a non-hunting item, like you said. Mm-hmm. It was raised at a hunting organization. And to, what that did was show
The world
that hunters care about our wildlife and hunters care about wildlife habitat. We care about endangered species, and that sustainable utilization is going to be the future of wildlife and a massive booming population, the country growing in population.
Yeah.
And that needs to be understood mm-hmm. first and foremost. I mean, and it's not just wildlife, it's marine life that's even threatened,
yeah.
you know. And that's because we consume it. It's a resource. We eat it. And, you know, I caught some slack saying, oh, you know, we're a little concerned, you know, custodianship. Wouldn't that be humanizing a wild animal? And I'm like, it's going to be humans that are going to be the only custodians of
yeah.
our,
they,
we are the only custodians
the
of our
custodians
wildlife,
of
you know,
wildlife.
So these animals were not, they're not being captured and put in a pen. You know, Mr. Warren's conservancy is 70,000 acres mm-hmm. of the best habitat for black rhino, you know, so they're not being put in small pens and raised like
cattle,
you know, they're still very wild. And, but something had to be done. I mean, 70% of the rhino population just in Kruger National Park has been poached.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did a podcast for Blood Origins, our friend Robbie Kroger,
mm-hmm.
you know. The day I did that, two rhinos were poached. Actually, three. It was two cows and a calf, 15 kilometers from Mr. Rippon's property. And the calf survived. They shot the calf three times. But we had to rush through and do our podcast then because Ms. Rippon had to get in a helicopter, you know, to look for the poachers. I mean, it's a real crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, I hope that message spreads back home here too,
yeah.
to just the stewardship of who we are, landowners, hunters, that we care about wildlife. And that's a passion of mine now
yeah.
is to spread that message. I still have to pinch myself. I can't believe we did what we did.
Yeah.
But it's proven that we can do it, you know, and it's catching the attention here at NRA. And it's I've already mm-hmm. spoke to some other foundations who are wanting to spread that message about how everybody that walks through these doors, even competition shooters, are a part of conservation.
Well, they are, because the manufacturers, firearms manufacturers, ammunition manufacturers, are the ones ultimately paying
yeah.
the tax for Pittman Robertson
That's
dollars.
Right.
And so shooting sports enthusiasts, obviously, Second Amendment advocates are buying and using firearms for plinking, for personal protection, for whatever reason, at a greater rate than hunters even
yeah.
buy hunting rifles. And so really the lion's share of conservation is done through the purchase of legal transfer
yeah.
of firearms. And yeah. a lot of people don't understand that. You mean the legal transfer of firearms has really transformed the landscapes of our country
yeah.
since the 1930s when the North American model was enacted.
That's
and
right.
And it has been ultimately the most successful model in the world because we have a great way to generate revenue.
That's right.
Other countries have tried to replicate the model, and it is very difficult because they don't have a revenue stream to attach to. And in the capacity that we have in the United States, because most countries don't have the firearms freedom that we have in the United States. I mean, it's sad to say that.
Yeah.
And so with that, hunting becomes an economy of its own that creates a value for wildlife, which funds and fuels the work that needs to be done in these other countries for conservation work, for anti-poaching efforts.
Yeah, and something I forgot to mention, too, we gave 100% of that money to Buffalo Kloof for their efforts.
Yeah.
We didn't retain it as a nonprofit, as a 501c3, as, you know, we didn't even keep DSC Foundation. The way the chapter programs work for DSC is they receive 20%, actually 25. And I went to the foundation president, and DSC Foundation allows their chapters to choose where they would like for their funds to be distributed. And I went to the DSC Foundation president, and I said, our chapter has a request, and that is we would like to be able to make the announcement live, no matter what this item brought, because I didn't know then, you know, that we gave 100% back to that conservancy. We had Mr. Rupin come into San Antonio, Texas, and graciously they supported us with that, you know. And so, I mean, my hat's off to them for allowing their chapter programs to do that, because that was a lot of money, which 20% of $500,000
is a lot of money.
And they, too, you know, so DSC Foundation
contributed
100%. And that's so I want, you know, that needs to be understood, too, out there in the world. I know some people think of fundraisers as, oh, you know, where does the money truly go? It was 100% donation we gave back right there that night in San Antonio, Texas. So, but yeah, special to be a part of it.
And it is special to be a part of.
I hope it's a, I mean, I'm, it's a, to me, it's a legacy that has been created for Buffalo Kloof and even for conservation. And, my focus is to do more of that type of work going forward. I mean, I've hunted the world. I've gotten to do a lot, you know, and there's a lot I still want to do, but, I hope we can blaze a trail and raise more awareness and get more hunters to support these organizations that are doing the right things for the right reasons.
Yeah, well, I mean, you think about, you know, we talked about Pittman Roberts and dollars and where those come from, and then, you know, how hunters fuel state economies for conservation through the tags and licenses, the purchase and acquisition of tags and licenses, and that equates to 75% of local budgets statewide.
Right.
But then hunters do this other thing, and it's a really great concept. It's called capitalism and free markets.
Yeah.
And amen. It's something that we participate in. So not only are we contributing with PR dollars through firearms and ammunition, and then now we have the Dingell-Johnson Act, which is for fishing. And it actually works, the PR dollars go through archery as well now. So not only do we do that, not only do we are we contributing to conservation through statewide tag and licenses, but we believe in free market conservation principles.
That's right.
And we do a step beyond those two things by participating in free market conservation groups like DSC, SCI, RMEF. I mean, there's a bunch of them out there. And, you know, we contribute large monetary funds. And there's, you know, a lot of times you'll go to a banquet and, you know, you'll see a sheep hunt or something sell for $400,000 or $500,000.
Right.
And a lot of people are like, man, that's so out of reach now. You know, I'll never be able to afford to buy a sheep tag, or I can never afford to do this. And the word never comes into mind. And it's actually the opposite, which should come to mind, is that because of these people, they're funding the collaring work, the habitat improvement work, the whatever work needs to be done, combating invasive species of plant life even. Because of these people, having the ability and the generosity to give through these organizations and to these organizations, they have operating funds to increase wildlife populations, which in turn provides opportunity for the average person.
That's right.
And you take, there's a really great ranch in Colorado, the River Canyon Ranch, owned by Bobby Hill. And he took a band of wild sheep and reintroduced them onto his private ranch. And within 5 years, they had a huntable
population
of wild sheep. And they work with Colorado Parks and Wildlife, and they issue public tags. So they get some tags that they can sell to help fund their their ranch management and, and habitat programs on the private ranch. But then also, they open that up to the public. And those tags are given to the public. So when the public, you know, 10 years ago never had this opportunity, now they do. And so we're all benefiting. The wildlife is benefiting. The habitat is benefiting. And so because these people are spending this money, we're all benefiting. And if you don't have money to spend, that's okay, too.
And that's okay, too.
You show up at the banquet. You buy raffle tickets. You go to dinner. You do a work project.
Buy a membership.
Buy a membership. Do a work project.
You know. If you, there's so many different ways to contribute.
And
everything
give.
You just said, it costs lots,
lots of money.
And we need to be grateful for those people who are have those resources to do what they do, because that's the future of being, just like you said, you know, that ranch that established that population, God, there's no telling how many hundreds of thousands of dollars that cost. And, you know, there's no telling how many millions of dollars Mr. Rippon has spent.
Yeah.
You know, to do what he's done in Africa. But that's happening here in North America. You know, I think it's important to know, too, that, you know, majority of the hunters we have globally are right here in North America.
Yeah.
You know, the percentage of those hunters here in North America, the percentage that hunts internationally, are it's very, very, very small.
Yeah.
So the majority of our hunters here, I think, don't pay attention, or I don't want to say don't care, but because they don't hunt internationally, or
it doesn't affect
globally,
them, so they turn a blind eye.
Exactly.
Until it's in their backyard,
but it's
and
so,
until it's knocking on their back door.
That's right. And it is now. It's starting to, right? You know, I was looking, I was watching some stuff on social media last night after the dinner, the NRA ILA dinner we were all at, about these winter storms that are taking, that are taking effect. And I was watching, you're from Wyoming, you live in Wyoming now.
Yes.
Holy cow, I did not realize the
impact.
The impact, what's happening to the pronghorn antelope and the mule deer over there.
That's right. It's terrible.
You know, and I'm reading comments.
I'm not even antelope hunting in Wyoming this year. I'm going to New Mexico.
I hope that they do something.
Yeah.
And I'm reading comments, and some people are pointing fingers, and I get it. You're entitled to an opinion, you know, and everybody's feelings are validated. That's the wrong approach, too. If, you know, if, as a hunter conservationist, you know, Mother Nature can be just awful.
Cruel.
And very cruel. And that's what's happened there.
Hey, you guys, if you're like me, you are totally dependent on OnX Hunt for nearly everything from hunting, navigating backcountry roads, even real estate. But being an elite member with OnX has so many benefits that you guys are going to want to take advantage of if you're not already doing so. For example, you're going to have access to all 50 states plus Canada with tons of valuable resource, landowner information, and you're also going to get added benefits like draw odds with Top Rut that will help you with all of your application seasons, and benefits through Hunting Fool magazine. And to boot, you guys, they've got tons of great specials through partners like Silencer Central, where if you're an OnX Elite member, you really benefit from those partnerships. So if you guys aren't a member, I encourage you, go online to the OnX Hunt website, use code WILD20 at checkout, and you're going to save 20%. You're going to love being an OnX Hunt Elite member.
I watched a video last night where some people in Wyoming watched a herd of bull elk. They were all carrying antlers. The last elk jumped a fence, and he was so worn from the winter, he entangled in the fence, ripped off one of his antlers, and laid there on the ground. Inevitably, without human intervention, probably would have laid there and died. And some passersby went and they untangled the bull elk from the fence. He jumps up, and there's another fence. He hits the next fence to jump again, so weak.
Can't do it.
Well, no, this was actually in Utah. I take that
Utah.
Back. This happened in Utah. Hits the next fence, falls again, and there's people in their car that are taking this video that were laughing. And they're like, oh, ha, ha, I hope he breaks his neck on the next one, on the next fence. I'll laugh if he breaks his neck.
Yeah.
Horrifying to me.
Horrifying to me.
Horrifying to me.
Where are the people that are against us as hunters? Because I can promise you what cattle rancher could afford it,
yeah.
or what rancher in those regions that have been impacted by this awful late winter or
horrible
very
winter.
Cold spring are feeding wildlife too.
Absolutely.
You know, I being in Texas, we've been in a horrible drought, you know, and I lease a ranch. And I've spent more money this year having to feed my deer.
Yeah.
We had zero fawn survival rate this year. Yeah.
Because
the ground
was so hot. Well,
that's
what they're predicting
in Southwest
Wyoming.
And I had to feed them
because
they had nothing to eat.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, those people that you're referring to that were laughing or making those videos, where's their contribution coming from?
Well,
the people that are against us.
They were sitting in their car watching this poor animal without even opening a car door. And there luckily was other people there that were on site that after the bull entangled in the second fence, they went and helped him out of it. And apparently they've been watching the herd now, and he's still alive. Hopefully with warmer weather, he will make it.
Yeah.
Praying. But, you know, last week my parents' employee had an antelope laying in their field, right in the same field as my mules. And he's laying out there, and they're watching him, and an eagle was eating it alive.
Yeah.
And the antelope was so weak from the winter, he couldn't get up. So he was laying there. The eagle's eating him alive. They call Fish and Game. Fish and Game come out, and they put the antelope down, and they allowed my parents' employees to keep the remaining quarters. Mm-hmm. And they did actually take some of the stomach and ribs because they had a pair of juvenile mountain lions that they were observing that were starving. And so they were baiting the Fish and Game had been baiting, using some meat to bait these juvenile mountain lions that were really struggling with the winter as well. So they did take some of it. The antelope was not wasted. But, I mean, these animals are so weakened by this winter to lay there and be eaten alive.
Yeah,
I can't even fathom what they've been through. It is absolutely heartbreaking.
Yep.
And as hunters, it is the worst thing you see. I mean, we're seeing videos coming out of Wyoming right now where the snow is melting. And as the snow melts, you just see 20 or 30 antelope being revealed under the snow that just laid down and couldn't get out.
That's what I was looking at last night.
Yeah.
And it's devastating. And that goes to show just what you're talking about as a hunter yourself and a conservationist and myself, that, you know, placing a value on this wildlife is what's going to save the wildlife. And it's no different. And I tell this to people all the time. It's no different than domestic wildlife.
Yeah.
Our cats, our dogs, you have dogs, you have horses, you have mules. You have them because there's a value to them.
Yeah.
You know, there's an emotional value to them. You know, the domestic animals, there's also a resource to them as far as like our cattle and our swine and our chickens and our turkeys and all that. You know, that's providing a natural resource and source of food to them. And so therefore we take care of them, right? We raise them, we feed them, we take care of them because they help us survive too. And so it all goes hand in hand.
Yeah.
You know, and that message is lost in our inner cities because of, I think, human population explosion. And it's not, people are forgetting about our lifestyle. People are forgetting about how those grocery stores.
Well, they're so removed from the process of harvesting.
Of all of it, you know. And
all they see is like this plastic wrapped piece of meat, and they don't realize, and I don't think most children realize that grow up in that environment that was actually associated. When you say chicken,
right. But if we didn't need it,
it comes from a chicken.
If we didn't need it, we wouldn't have it.
Yeah.
Right? And so.
Which is why the locavore movement's so powerful, I feel like. And farm to table and, you know, consumption of wild game. I think is being looked at in a different manner now, especially when we start to really dissect agricultural and practices of, you know, modern production.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not going to poo-poo any practice that anybody's doing because we're all trying to do the best we can
That's
to make
right.
a living or, you know, generate a good product for
That's
consumers.
Right.
But for me personally, I love that I open the freezer and I have a memory with my meal.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, 100%. And I know, I just didn't run down to the old grocery
and I can take care of myself.
Yes.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. But we do also have to be stewards of wildlife.
That's
and I
right.
think that like this year, for example, in Wyoming, they're already, you know, proposing cutting back massive amounts of hunting opportunities.
So.
And as a hunter, that's great. I'm happy to see that. I'm not going to hunt antelope in my own state this year. One of the reasons I moved to Wyoming is, I can hunt antelope every year. Yeah. This isn't the year to hunt them. They need a break. We had a really bad EHD outbreak last year, and the deer and the antelope were already suffering from that in our area. I'm going to New Mexico.
Yeah,
I'm going to go to a different area, hunt a different species, and that's what hunters do. We really pull behind these animals and want to see them have a great chance
at life.
That's right.
I mean, Texas, too. I mean, I lease a ranch, and our deer densities in most of Texas are very, very high. You know, South Texas particularly, where I'm at. We have a very large deer density. And with the drought, one of the worst droughts I've seen, living in Texas for 48 years now. That normally every year we set a quota, on how many bucks and does we're going to take.
Yeah.
We, for years, have always taken more does than bucks just to keep an even ratio and to improve genetics. And this is on free-range country. But this year, we cut our doe quota way back, simply because of the zero fawn survival rate. You know, because we'll see a generation gap from that.
That's right.
You know, in 5 years, we're going to go, we're not going to have this age class of deer. And being very mindful of that as a conservationist and even as a hunter, that this year we shot older buck. We always shoot older bucks. We always look for deer that are 6 years of age and older. In Texas, we're able to do that because of our deer density compared to other regions across the nation. But, this year we really just, we had a lot of our bucks went downhill. They regressed, I would say, 25-30%, not only just in antler development, but body weights as well. And so it wasn't their year, we fed them, we took care of them, we did everything we could to keep them alive, and that's what we did, you know, and we took some older deer that were way past their prime, that still eat just as good. And
that's one of the beautiful things that sheep hunters are really good at, too,
they
really harvest that upper echelon of age class, and most reputable outfitters will have a harvest objective of 10 years and older, because after a sheep hits the age of 10, their chance of survival every year diminishes, and it starts at that 10%, and it goes down from there. And so this word of like trophy hunting is so stigmatized when it really should be selective hunting. Mm-hmm. Like, we're selecting an animal based on his life cycle contribution.
I love that.
And selective hunting is a way, Jason Matzinger just did a really cool film called Selective, mm-hmm. where he really talks about people wanting to, trophy hunting has this horrible stigma to it. Horrible. But if you were to say, no, I'm selectively harvesting, and people are like, well, what does that mean?
I think
it begs a question instead of an media-driven negative response.
100%. And I think, to me, trophy, the word trophy, is in the eye of every hunter.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? That trophy, you made a point a minute ago, when you open up that freezer and that memory that it brings that's the trophy.
Yeah.
In my eyes. And so selective, that's a great word. That's a great word to continue to use going forward. Selective hunting,
mm-hmm.
Choosing
in Europe,
the age
class. They have massive populations of moose in Sweden, and their part of their selective hunting is harvesting of calves, of calf moose. And to me, it blows my mind.
Yeah.
But they'll harvest a calf and leave the cow.
Yeah.
And so they have a different type of selection that they use in different harvest objectives than, maybe traditional here in the United States. But, a lot of places have some sort of model that they're adhering to for conservation of wildlife.
Sure.
And it really needs to go back to hunters are ultimately responsible for our wildlife, because we're funding it, we're fueling it, we're driving it. Anyway, we could go on for an hour. I want to talk with you about some of your Ruger favorites, though.
What's that?
What are some of your favorite rifles? What do you
some
like
of my
shooting?
Favorite
yeah,
rifles.
I want
oh
to
my
know.
Gosh.
What are some of your Ruger, like, what is your go-tos when you are hunting?
I'm traditional. I'm old school. I love the older calibers.
He's old school, but not old. Okay.
I'm not old. I have an appreciation for all the new Wildcat cartridges that everybody's producing these days, but I still love the traditional. I love the old 30s, the 308, the 30-06, the 300 Win Mag. Below that, I love the my favorite whitetail deer.
He just listed a couple that I'm like, nope, nope.
Love the, you know, love the 275 Rigby, which is a 7x57 Mauser, my favorite whitetail cartridge right there. I shoot that a lot in a Ruger number one, you know. I love the old falling block actions. I love Ruger number ones. I'm a collector of Ruger number ones. I'm a collector of the M77s and the Hawkeyes, you know. You know, for my international hunting, pretty much my go-to has always been a 300 Win Mag or the 375 Ruger. Mm-hmm. I've used the 416 Ruger on some African safaris. I've also used the 450-400. I do like big calibers. I'm absolutely having a blast with the new Ruger Made Marlins, the 1895 models, the 4570. Yeah. I know they've made
I was them. Just going to ask you.
Oh, listen, you know, the new series coming out this third quarter, about half of it will be with the 1895 model. And one of the greatest things, I know it's very popular that what Ruger's done for them is threaded the barrel for suppressors, but I love things that go boom. And I love recoil.
I did put a suppressor on mine because that thing's got big boom.
When conditions get tough on a mountain hunt, your gear must be tougher. Making every opportunity count means selecting equipment that will not fail. Any condition, anywhere, Hornady Outfitter ammunition is designed to perform. Available in a wide range of cartridges from 243 to 375 Ruger. When you're looking for a hard-hitting, deep penetrating bullet and cartridge that performs in the most rugged environments, look no further than Hornady Outfitter ammunition.
So I do like big calibers. You know, being an ambassador for Ruger, just like you, you know, sharing the love between all their products, I'm very, you know, I advocate for. But if I can pull that Ruger number one out of the safe and use it, I will.
Yeah.
You know, my grandfather was
it's
a
nostalgic.
Ruger number one. Yeah, my grandfather was a Ruger number one dealer, you know, and he kind of just going back in time with him, he was a part of Sears Roebuck. I don't know if you remember the chain store of Sears Roebuck.
So oh, yeah.
He was brought to Texas to open up the Sears Roebuck chain stores in Texas. And so Ruger number ones were sold back then in the store. And that's where his collection came from.
Yeah.
And so since a little boy looking at his, you know, glass case, you know, gun cases in his home, I just fantasized over all those number ones. You know, I wish I had all of them today. He got rid of some. You know, throughout his life, I do have some of them, but having an absolute blast with the lever guns this year, whitetail deer hunting, elk hunting, nail guy hunting down on the Texas coast. I'm going to Africa with the 1895 and going to hunt Cape Buffalo. Hornady's helping me work up some ammunition.
I might be doing that in 2025. No,
come
24.
Let's
24
do it together.
I'm doing that. Yeah.
Let's do it
come
together.
Come with us. We have a spot in camp.
I love Africa.
Let's We have our dates set.
Let's do it. I'm going to hunt the Nyanaya Conservancy this year.
Yeah.
In June.
So when you're we'll man, I'm like legitimate serious. We talk to Yogi offline when we're done.
I would love to.
And you come with us.
And I want you to come to Texas.
It's Mozambique. It's going to be amazing.
Oh, Mozambique. Love Mozambique.
It's going to be amazing.
Hot and humid. Great mosquito country. Wading through the swamps. At, you know.
I'm not going.
You'll be hopping from lily pad to lily pad.
I am not going in a swamp after a Cape Buffalo. I'm not doing it.
Get ready.
Next thing
Isn't
you know, I'm
right,
going to be
Yogi?
Walking like this with my gun over my head through a swamp. And I'm going to be like, I hate you.
I'll tell you a funny story about Mozambique.
I don't want snakes and alligators or crocodiles. Like,
I got to go to Mozambique when it first opened after their war.
Mm.
And we were in the swamps. And I am a big guy, you know, and these little trackers, you know, you're following them around and you're wading through water and you're watching them hop from lily pad to lily pad. The lily pads are as big as this desk we're sitting here, you know, and they stay on top, you know, like they can land on one foot and it starts to sink, you know, and then they hop to another one and you're going to the deeper water. You think this, my big ass.
You're like, boom.
Oh, I hopped on one and I just, you know.
Straight down.
I was so frustrated, you know. But
straight down.
You know, you're wet all day from either the humidity, and that's so much part of the adventure. But no, Texas, you have to come to Texas. I've been asking you to, I know you come to Texas, but we need to do a deer hunt.
Oh, yes,
you
know, we do.
Together. I would love to rattle up a buck for you.
Ooh, that's like my favorite.
And do it with a lever gun.
Ask my husband. I'll be in a tree stand, and we'll be whitetail deer hunting, and when they're chasing, I'm like, my teeth are chattering. I get so jacked up. And he's like, you have to stop moving. You're shaking the camera. And I'm like, I get like full on like crackhead. Like,
I'm the same way.
Oh, white-tailed deer when they're chasing, like you never know what's going to come in. It's so exciting.
When they're basically from, like, and the viewers can't see that, but when they're almost as close as the cameras are to us right now, and their noses are dripping and their eyes are this big, you know, and their hair is standing up. I mean, I've had some this year where I sit there and I had to like throw the horns at them, like and like scare them off, like because, you know. What the deer I wanted to shoot, didn't want to have to shoot it. I got me, I got a cameraman, you know, and I've never had one really try to get us, but I've had him close enough to where I was like, that's enough. That's good enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And,
so I'd love for you to come down to Texas.
Yeah.
But back on the guns, I guess you could just call me. I just, old school, I love that. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited about what's coming out. The 336 is out.
Yeah. 30, I know my husband's 30, driving me nuts on the 336.
You know, I can guarantee you're going to see me in the field in the whitetail world, you know, with that this next fall. And excited to see what they produce going forward.
Yeah.
You know, so, but Africa, when I go, I'll have the 45-70 and I'll have a 375 Ruger with me.
Yeah, I'll have both. Yeah,
so,
same.
Yeah, but what about you, though? You do a lot. More, you know, with where the other calibers are for so much of that. Your competition shooting that you really got into.
So the 45-70, my husband's obsessed with. It's not that fun to shoot. It's not that fun. I love the rifle. It's beautiful. I haven't taken it hunting yet. It's a shorter range rifle. And
it is.
Where I live in Wyoming and
you
where we
range.
Hunt in Oregon, tend to lean a little on range. So, you know, for me, 6.5 PRC was really like, well, it started with 6.5 Creedmoor.
Yep.
And then when the PRC came out, I was like, okay, I'm all about PRC. And I hunted with that a lot last year, but kind of kicking back and forth between Creedmoor and PRC. And now that we have the 7 PRC, this year, I'm dying. That's coming out in a Ruger American. It's got the Go Wild camo, super, super sexy barrel. It's like this bronze Cerakote color, fluted. It is just a beautiful gun. I can't wait to hunt with it. So I'll be doing that this year or taking that out this year and hunting with that. And I'm excited about it. But I like to be able to get some extended range. So, you know, if I need to make a 400-yard shot, 500-yard shot, I want to be able to take it if it's a good situation for it. So I tend to choose those calibers that do well in the wind and, you know, give me some, you know, you're talking 308. I'm like, man, if I'm off on my wind call like 2 miles an hour with a 308 at 500 yards, you have some problems. My 6.5 Creedmoor or 6.5 PRC, boom, I'm still shooting, right?
That's right,
like,
exactly.
So I like the versatility that some of those better performing cartridges offer.
Yeah.
You know, and Hornady makes ammo for, you know, the PRC, Creedmoor, that's their baby, right? And so the advent of the precision rifle cartridge really has kind of transformed so much in the shooting sports. And the Creedmoor, in just like, 13 years, the Creedmoor went, you know, everybody went from never hearing of a Creedmoor to it being in every available fire manufacturer, model, make.
Yeah.
And it's just really revolutionized the shooting industry.
No, it has.
So those are kind of, for me, I've always been a Hornady shooter. And so...
me too.
That's kind of the way it's always worked for me.
Too.
So those are my babies, you know.
I'm hearing great things on the 7 PRC. I mean, so
I
do you think
imagine.
It's going to take over?
Amanda, you shoot 7 PRC versus 300 Win Mag, I'm probably going to go with a 7. But, you know, right now you're not going to have the ammo availability. So there's always that, you know, there's always a trade-off with a new cartridge until it really catches on.
That's
so,
right.
You know, those tried and trues that you're talking about, like 30-06, I've got one of the Ruger American .06 in Sweden because that's what we could find in a Ruger American. And we can find ammo for it. And it's legal for pigs and deer. So... I have an .06 in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a lot of the reasons why I stick to those calibers. Being an international hunter that I've, you know, the last 20 years hunting internationally, that can be an issue.
It is
you
an
know,
issue.
You to think about, you know, even when the 375 Ruger first came out, you know, it's a more prevalent to find now, like in Africa, but in the beginning it wasn't.
Well,
you
last
know,
year
H&H,
when I went,
you'd find it all day long, you know, so those are things that I was mindful of and stuck with for those type of hunts internationally. Like, and for my long range hunts, the 300 Win Mag was mostly my go-to because if I got to Asia, I could find some 300 Win Mag if my ammo didn't show
up. That's correct.
You know?
And there's a lot with that. So like for when I went to South Africa last year, we brought bullets and actually one of the PHs in camp reloaded ammunition for us. So I didn't have to mess with bringing ammo and kind of dealing with that. So, and then I left them in camp. I was like, here you guys go. It's a gift. There is ammunition and accessibility to ammunition if heaven forbid it gets lost or separated, you know, because like some of those countries, you can't have your ammo in with your firearm. You have to have it locked separate and rules. And
there's all
and
the different countries. Yep.
There's all kinds of variables of things that could go wrong.
Absolutely.
So I try to eliminate those variables as much as you can. But I tend to be on the cutting edge of let's shoot what's new and
oh, absolutely.
But there is always a place for those old tried and trues, which is why they're still around. So
yeah, exactly.
How does everybody find you on social media? Like if they want to follow you, they want to watch Trailing the Hunter's Moon. Where do people
absolutely.
Do that?
Trailing the Hunter's Moon is going to air, airs on Pursuit Channel and on their digital platform Pursuit Up, but Carbon TV as well. You and I share.
Yeah,
Carbon
we're
TV
both
platforms.
Going to be Pursuit Carbon people now.
Yes,
that's
right.
Exciting.
You told me. Yeah. So really happy with Judy McQueen has done with Carbon
She's
TV.
Amazing.
She's amazing. They've been very good to me as far as promoting as well.
Yeah.
On the social outlets, Facebook, Trailing the Hunter's Moon. On Instagram, Blake Barnett Hunting. I had more people kind of gravitate and find me by looking at my name that way. So we changed it, but it's still the home of the Trailing the Hunter's Moon as well.
Yeah.
On Instagram. And then YouTube, Trailing the Hunter's Moon. You will find us there. And that's pretty much it. You know, I'm not as big of a social influencer as the rock star you are, but love to collaborate there, where we can.
Yeah.
And that's home for now. I don't think I'm going to venture beyond that. I mean, I'm very happy with Carbon TV. I'm very happy with the Pursuit channel.
Yeah, it's a great combo.
And, absolutely. And I know YouTube's growing, is popular amongst the younger generation.
Yeah.
So we're there as well, Instagram, I'm probably a little more active on the Instagram side than I am the Facebook side. Just like to scroll through those feeds more than the other. So, that's where you can find me.
Well,
look
you guys,
us up. Like us.
Yes. Like them. Look them up. We appreciate all of you for tuning in. And if you guys like this podcast, I want to invite you all. Please give us a 5-star review wherever you listen. Share the podcast. If you know somebody you think might enjoy listening to what we talked about today, please share that podcast. And then tell your friends. Like, subscribe, share. Thank you all for joining us for this episode of the Wild and Uncut podcast. And we will see you all next time.
Thank you for listening to the Wild and Uncut podcast. If you would like to hear more, be sure to subscribe to my Pursue the Wild digital series on YouTube and follow me at Christy Titus on Facebook and Instagram.